Imagine walking down a bustling street in 1911. You've just moved to a new city. You're trying to build a life.
Right, just trying to get by.
Exactly. And you stop for a second on a corner to watch a neighborhood craps game. Then, in the blink of an eye, the police sweep in.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You're thrown before a rigged judge who bangs a gavel, and just like that, the next 7 years of your life are sold to a chain gang.
Just completely gone.
Erased. You don't exist anymore. And that isn't some, you know, dystopian fiction plot. That was the terrifying, entirely legal reality at the heart of our deep dive today. We're exploring a true masterpiece of the American theater, August Wilson's Joe Turner's Come and Gone.
It really is a towering achievement in literature. And what makes it so powerful is that it refuses to stay locked in the past. It forces you to look at the mechanics of history and how they shape human identity.
And there has literally never been a better time to understand this story. Right now, in spring 2026, there is a massive Broadway revival happening starring Taraji P. Henson and Cedric the Entertainer.
Which is such an amazing cast.
It really is. Plus, Denzel Washington is currently producing a screen adaptation for Netflix. So the cultural footprint of this play is just everywhere. But to really get it, we have to look at the foundation.
Right, the broader context of Wilson's work.
Yeah. This is the second installment of Wilson's century cycle, which is sometimes called the Pittsburgh cycle. He basically wrote one play for every decade of the 20th century to chronicle the African American experience.
That's a massive undertaking.
Huge. And interestingly, he originally called this specific play Mill Hands' Lunch Bucket, naming it after a painting by Romare Bearden, before he kind of pivoted to focus on this much darker, more profound theme.
What's fascinating here is the specific historical pressure cooker Wilson places us in. It's 1911. We are in a boarding house in Pittsburgh. The Civil War is in the rearview mirror, but we are right at the dawn of the Great Migration.
Right, so huge demographic shifts.
Exactly. You have thousands of formerly enslaved African Americans fleeing the South, pouring into northern cities. They're looking for wages, sure, but fundamentally, they're searching for a sense of self in a country that has systematically stripped them of it.
Okay, let's unpack this boarding house setting because the location itself is doing so much heavy lifting. I mean, if you think about it, Seth and Bertha Hawley's boarding house is essentially a 1911 version of a bustling airport lounge.
An airport lounge, I like that.
Yeah, because everyone passing through those doors is in transit. They've landed in this unfamiliar terminal. They're looking for a connecting flight, or they're just, you know, waiting for the weather to clear so they can figure out their final destination.
Right, it's a waiting room.
Exactly. But here is the psychological toll, right? Nobody is meant to live in Terminal B forever. You'd eventually go crazy.
That is a brilliant way to frame it because the owners of the boarding house represent two completely different ways of managing that transient chaos.
Okay, break that down for us.
Well, since we're dealing with a world where everyone knows the basic setup, Seth Hawley is the strict northern-born capitalist who makes pots and dustpans. The real tension isn't what he does for a living. It's why he does it.
Right, his motivations.
Exactly. Seth's obsession with commerce and respectability is his armor. By obsessively making dustpans and judging the Southern arrivals for not acting like proper Northerners, he's insulating himself from their trauma.
Oh, I see. So if he can turn them into a simple business transaction, he doesn't have to face the absolute devastation they brought up from the South.
Precisely. He's building a wall out of capitalism.
And then you have his wife, Bertha, who approaches the exact same chaotic environment with a philosophy of absolute grace.
She's at the heart of the place, Willie.
She is. She anchors the house with the belief that love and laughter are the only real currencies that matter. But, you know, the minute you step off Bertha's porch, that illusion of northern freedom shatters.
It does. The reality hits hard.
We talk a lot about systemic racism, but Wilson shows us the actual mechanics of it through the character of Jeremy. He's this 25-year-old guitar player.
Jeremy is the perfect test case for the North's false promise. I mean, he represents the young, liberated generation. He gets a construction job building a
It
road.
sounds like a solid start.
It does. But he doesn't just face abstract prejudice. He faces a literal toll booth. A white foreman extorts him, demanding Jeremy pay him 50 cents a week just to keep the job he already has.
Wait, to keep his own job?
Yeah. And when Jeremy refuses to be extorted, he gets fired. And even prior to that, he is arrested by white police officers for simply walking down the street falsely accused of being drunk.
Jeez, it's just an inescapable economic trap. The system is entirely designed to extract whatever meager capital these migrants manage to accumulate.
Which seamlessly leads us to the most chilling economic mechanism in the play, Rutherford Seelig.
Yes, the white peddler who buys Seth's dustpans. And he's known around town as the People Finder. For a fee, he tracks down missing people.
Now, on paper, a people finder sounds like a vital service for a displaced community, right?
Yeah, you'd think so.
But if we connect this to the bigger picture of Seelig's family tree, the dark irony is staggering. Seelig openly admits his ancestors were the ones who brought Africans across the Atlantic on slave ships.
Oh, wow.
Then his father tracked down runaway slaves for plantation owners. And now Seelig gets paid by the descendants of those slaves to track down the families his own family scattered.
So he is literally monetizing the intergenerational trauma his own bloodline created. That is so dark.
It is the evolution of exploitation. History doesn't just disappear, you know, it just changes its legal packaging. Seelig represents how the commerce of human trafficking transitions seamlessly into the commerce of helping the displaced.
Right, helping with huge air quotes. Seelig's economy of displacement perfectly explains the shattered psychology of the people forced to use his services. And here's where it gets really interesting.
Oh, I know where you're going with this.
How can a play be named after a character who never speaks a single line, never makes an appearance on stage, but completely dominates the lives of everyone in the room? I mean, who is Joe Turner?
To understand the phantom antagonist of Joe Turner, we really have to look at the gaping legal loophole left at the end of the Civil War. The 13th Amendment abolished slavery and involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for a crime.
Right, the exception clause.
Precisely. And Joe Turner is based on a very real, very terrifying historical figure named Joe Turney. He was the brother of Peter Turney, the governor of Tennessee.
So he had some serious political connections.
Exactly. Because of his political immunity, Joe Turney exploited that 13th Amendment loophole to industrialize a new form of slavery called peonage.
And the sources we have, including the autobiography of W.C. Handy, the father of the blues, they break down exactly how this machine operated.
It was incredibly systematic.
It was. It wasn't just men being snatched in the dark. It was a highly coordinated legal trap. The law would plant a stool pigeon on a street corner to start a craps game. They'd roll the dice, wait for a crowd of black men to gather, and then spring the trap.
The police would arrest the entire crowd for minor gambling infractions. Then they'd run them through a kangaroo court, slap them with a fine they couldn't possibly pay, and sentence them to forced labor.
And then what?
Then they were handed directly over to Joe Turney's chain gang for 7 years.
Just put yourself in those shoes for a second. You step out of your house to go to the store, you pause at a corner, and a rigged legal mechanism legally kidnaps you for 7 years.
It's unfathomable.
You vanish. And when the wives and children left behind asked where their husbands went, the community's only answer was a haunting blues refrain. They tell me Joe Turner's come and gone.
And Wilson uses that blues song as the title, because Joe Turner isn't just a man. He is the terrifying embodiment of a system designed to steal a person's labor, their family, and ultimately their soul.
Which brings us to the man whose soul was directly stolen, Harold Loomis. When he walks into the boarding house in mid-August, we aren't just looking at a dramatic entrance.
No, we're looking at the direct collateral damage of Joe Turner's economy.
Exactly. Loomis is 32. He has his 11-year-old daughter, Zonia, with him. And Seth immediately describes him as mean-looking. But the detail that sticks with me is his outfit. It's the dead of summer, and Loomis is wearing a heavy winter overcoat and a hat.
That heavy overcoat in August is just a brilliant physical manifestation of a man completely frozen in time. Loomis is trapped in an internal winter.
What was his life like before he was taken?
Well, before he was kidnapped by Joe Turner, Loomis was a deacon in the Abundant Life Church. He was actually out on the street trying to preach to a group of gamblers trying to save souls when the trap was sprung.
Oh, man. So his reward for trying to do a good deed was 7 years of slavery. No wonder his worldview is broken.
Yeah. He survived those 7 years by mentally clinging to the image of his wife, Martha, and his daughter. But when he was finally released and made it back home, he found that Martha couldn't wait any longer.
She had moved on.
She had left, leaving Zonia with her grandmother. So Loomis's entire identity, preacher, husband, free man, was violently severed.
I'm theorizing here, but when he hires Rutherford Seelig to find Martha, he's not really looking for his wife, is he?
What do you mean?
I mean, he's looking for the 1904 version of himself. He thinks if he can just locate the woman who knew him before the trauma, he can magically rewind the clock.
Wow, that's a really profound read. He's searching for completeness in someone else because he's entirely disconnected from his own purpose.
Right.
But what Wilson beautifully illustrates is that Loomis isn't the only one in that house trying to piece an identity back together.
True. The women in this boarding house are absolutely fascinating. I look at them almost like evolutionary adaptations to the hostile environment of the Great Migration.
No.
Well, when creatures are placed under immense stress, they generally do one of three things. They seek shelter, they adapt to fight, or they run.
I like that framework a lot. Let's look at Maddie Campbell through that lens. She's 25, and she is definitively the one seeking shelter.
Yes, she is so desperate for an anchor that she comes to the boarding house looking for a conjure man to cast a spell to bring her ex-boyfriend back. And when that fails, she just moves right in with Jeremy.
Maddie's tragedy is that she represents a deeply conditioned subservience. She's part of a generation that is technically free, but psychologically, she still feels she needs a master.
Or in her case, a man.
Exactly, a man to validate her existence. She hasn't learned that she possesses her own agency.
Contrast that with Molly Cunningham. Molly is 26, fiercely independent, and she is the one who adapts to run.
She really is.
She flat out refuses to ever return to the South, and she rejects any traditional domestic role. She eventually runs off with Jeremy, but you get the sense she's doing it entirely on her own terms.
And then there is Loomis's estranged wife, Martha. She's 28, and her survival strategy was assimilation.
How did she manage the trauma?
Well, to survive the agonizing loss of her husband to Joe Turner's chain gang, she completely rejected her African roots. She threw herself fully into the evangelical church and moved her life north. She essentially adopted the religion of the dominant culture as a shield.
It's heartbreaking because you understand the sheer necessity behind every single one of those choices. And while the adults are acting out these trauma responses, the children are quietly absorbing everything.
The kids are so important here.
Yeah, you have Loomis's daughter, Zonia, and the neighbor boy, Reuben.
Those children are crucial because they represent the malleable next generation. They actually share a kiss in the yard and promise to marry each other when they grow up.
Not the sweet, but there's a darker undertone, right?
Definitely. Wilson embeds a subtle warning in Reuben. Reuben claims the ghost of Seth's mother visited him, and because of a promise he made to that ghost, he releases a pen of pigeons.
So Reuben is already deeply tuned into the spiritual world, the repeating patterns of the past.
Right. And this raises an important question. If this incoming generation just blindly mimics the adults, aren't they doomed?
The cycle continues.
The underlying warning is that history is cyclical. If these kids don't find a new way to synthesize their history, the traumas of the 19th century will just keep reinventing themselves in the 20th.
Which means someone has to break the cycle. Someone has to teach them a new way. And that brings us to the spiritual center of the boarding house, Bynum Walker.
Bynum is such a compelling character.
He is. He's in his 60s, an African conjure man who does ritualistic pigeon sacrifices, much to Seth's absolute horror, by the way.
Seth hates it.
But beyond the rituals, Bynum operates on this beautiful, unifying philosophy. He talks about meeting a shiny man on the road who taught him that every single person in the world has a song.
And Bynum's concept of the song is Wilson's ultimate metaphor for a person's soul, their undeniable purpose, and their self-determined identity.
And Bynum knows his own song, right?
Yes. His is the binding song, which he uses to draw people together who belong together.
But I'm struggling to understand how Bynum's philosophy collides with Loomis, especially at the end of Act One. They've just finished dinner, and they start a juba dance.
The juba is such a powerful moment.
For context, the juba is a call-and-response rhythm dance deeply tied to African ring shouts. Seth is blowing the harmonica, Bynum is drumming. The stage directions say it should be as African as possible. They're in this joyous religious frenzy.
And then Harold Loomis violently interrupts it.
Yes. Yeah. He screams at them to stop, starts speaking in tongues, and collapses in a hallucination. Wait, if Loomis is severed from his roots, wouldn't a joyous African dance be exactly what cures him? Why does a moment of heritage cause him to completely break down?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it's because Loomis is terrified of it. The juba touches the raw nerve of an African identity he feels abandoned by.
Oh, because of his past as a deacon?
Right. Remember, Loomis put all his faith in the Christian church as a deacon, but his Christianity didn't protect him from Joe Turner's men. So now he's trapped in a spiritual no man's land.
He's stuck.
He's alienated from the religion that failed him, but he's too traumatized to embrace the ancestral heritage Bynum is offering. The juba forces him to confront the emptiness inside himself.
Okay, let's unpack that finale then, because the way he finally escapes that no man's land is one of the most intense sequences in theater. It's Saturday. Loomis and Zonia are about to be kicked out by Seth.
The tension is incredibly high.
And suddenly, Martha walks through the door.
Selig brings her. And in the stunning twist, Martha reveals that the reason she and Zonia were finally reunited isn't just coincidence. Years ago, she paid Bynum to put a binding spell on them.
So Bynum's binding song actually worked. The magic is real.
Yes.
But the reunion is completely devastating. Loomis pours out the agony of the last decade. You know, the chains, the searching, the desperation. And Martha just looks at him and delivers the hardest truth imaginable.
She couldn't wait forever.
Right. She mourned him, she assumed he was gone, and she rebuilt her life without him. She's not going back.
And that rejection completely shatters the illusion Loomis has been carrying for 7 years. He realizes the 1904 version of his life is dead. So in an absolute rage, he pulls out a knife.
Hold on. I have to push back here. In the play's climax, Loomis denounces his Christian background, turns the knife on himself, and slashes his own chest right in front of his estranged wife and daughter.
Yeah, it's a lot.
You called this a masterpiece of dramatic resolution earlier. But slashing yourself in a rage, that sounds like a complete mental break. That sounds like the ultimate manifestation of trauma, not a victory. How is that self-sufficiency?
It is incredibly shocking, I agree. But Wilson's stage directions are explicit here, and we have to view it through the lens of Bynum's spiritual framework. It is not a tragic suicide attempt.
It's not.
No, it is a blood sacrifice. By slashing his own chest, Loomis is bleeding out the toxic history that has infected him. He is severing the umbilical cord to a past that kept him frozen.
Wow, so he's literally bleeding out Joe Turner's poison?
Exactly. When he realizes Martha can't save him, and his old religion can't save him, he takes his own blood into his own hands. The stage directions state that in this moment, Loomis has found his song, the song of self-sufficiency.
That'd be heavy.
He is no longer waiting to be rescued or defined by anyone else. He takes full ownership of his pain and his existence.
It's an agonizing rebirth. But as Loomis turns and walks out of the boarding house, leaving Zonia with Martha, finally, a free, autonomous man Bynum shouts that iconic final line at his back.
Yes.
Harold Loomis, you shining. You shining like new money.
He becomes the shiny man Bynum spoke of at the beginning of the play, the man who has discovered the secret of life by discovering himself.
So what does this all mean? We know this play is dripping with accolades, the New York Drama Critics Circle Award, multiple Tonys, a permanent place in the Western canon. But beyond the trophies and the brilliant historical chronicling of the Great Migration, it is a masterclass in the mechanics of identity.
It truly is. And while The Boarding House is strictly 1911, the underlying struggle is fiercely relevant today. The play demands that we look at the systemic forces that try to define us, the toxic histories that weigh us down, and realize that true identity isn't something you are handed.
You have to make it.
It must be forged, sometimes painfully, by your own hands.
You cannot wait for a Rutherford Selig to map out your path, and you absolutely cannot let a Joe Turner steal your future. Which leaves us with a final question for you to ponder long after this deep dive is over. Imagine Bynum Walker is sitting across the table from you right now, drumming his fingers on the wood, looking right through your armor. What would he say your song is? And more importantly, did you write that song yourself, or did society hand it to you?